May it please the court. I'm Denise Canada, registration number 41793, and I represent Appellant Pinnacle Assurance. Appellants seek reversal of the trial court orders granting summary judgment to the appellee AMI. As you are aware, this case involves an iron worker named Richard Voss who was critically injured when he was struck by a massive steel column while using a hoisting system that was within the exclusive control of AMI with a hoist ring provided by AMI. I'm going to split my time this morning with counsel for the Voss appellants, Mr. Brady. I'm going to be addressing the trial court's failure to recognize disputed material facts, and Mr. Brady will address the issue of duty as well as the wrong of another. In the limited time that I have, I want to speak briefly about several significant disputed facts. The size of the hoist ring bolt that was provided by AMI, the condition of the hoist ring when it was provided, and the sequence of construction, specifically the installation of steam pipes by AMI before the pipe support system was installed by Mr. Voss and his coworkers. With respect to the size of the hoist ring bolt, AMI supervisor Kevin Tomczyk simply provided the wrong size bolt, and that's supported by our expert, Steve Miller. In Mr. Miller's report and affidavit, he indicates that the bolt Tomczyk provided was 1/2 inch too short, and that 1/2 inch made all the difference. The accident never would have happened if the proper size bolt had been provided. And Ridge Erection co-workers of Mr. Voss, Creech and Dressen, also testified at deposition about the shorter bolt. AMI disagrees with that. They say, well, the bolt size isn't even relevant, and if it was, there's no evidence that the hoist ring wasn't the proper size. So that's clearly a disputed fact, and it's clearly material because the injury never would have occurred if the longer length bolt had been provided.
Counsel, I'm a little concerned about this whole idea of disputed facts in this context. It is the court's obligation to determine as a matter of law whether there is a duty. The court doesn't decide, are there disputed issues of material fact? Oh, if there are, I've got to submit that question to the jury. It's not what the court does. So why are you arguing that there are disputed issues of material fact? It seems to me you should be arguing the facts show that there was a duty or the facts show there wasn't a duty as a matter of law, because that's what the court has to decide.
I understand, Your Honor. I think the issue of the underlying facts is important and necessary for determination of the duty. The only way you can determine whether a duty existed is to consider the facts and circumstances at the time, what was happening at the time, and the underlying facts.
But I don't think there's any dispute, if I can use that word, that there is some testimony or some evidence that the bolt was too short, for example, and some testimony that it doesn't matter, for example. I don't think there's any dispute about the fact there is a dispute about that. I think what the dispute here is about is whether that means there's a duty or not. Why don't we talk about the legal issue, whether there's a duty?
All right. The with respect to duty, and again, Mr. Brady is going to handle that part of the argument, but I think that the creation of the duty, I mean, the fact that AMI provided the wrong size bolt and did the construction out of sequence and failed to provide the proper instructions are all things that created the risk that then gave rise to the duty.
Along the same lines, it seems to me that the first question is, was there a duty and what was the nature of the duty? And then obviously, if there was a duty to provide a bolt of the correct size and there's a dispute about whether that happened, then there's genuine issue of material fact and it has, and summary judgment would be improperly granted. If there is a duty first to provide a bolt of a correct size, to sequence the construction differently, and the condition, was it the condition of the ring that you're talking about? How was it that there was a duty to provide a bolt of a correct size?
The duty, Your Honor, again, and I'll be happy to defer to Mr. Brady on that. If you'd prefer to hear the duty arguments initially, we can do that.
Well, it seems like what you're arguing about is whether there was a breach or not. I mean, all these disputed facts that you're pointing to go to the issue of whether they can be held liable for breaching a duty. But it begs the question in the first instance, was there a duty? The trial court found there wasn't a duty. So we're reviewing that decision. That's what's critical to us. Was there a duty or not?
All right. Well, let me just let Mr. Brady respond to that then, and I'll reserve my argument about the remaining disputed facts.
Thank you.
Bill Brady, Your Honors, for the Voss plaintiffs. The question of duty is central to the court's determination, and it is the plaintiff's position that the wrong test was used. The court used the test for nonfeasance and not for misfeasance. Nonfeasance presupposes the existence of a special relationship. The court found that there was none here. Misfeasance does not presuppose a special relationship. Misfeasance occurs when the actor undertakes a duty to another person and engages in conduct that fails to prevent harm to the person to whom it has accepted the duty. In misfeasance cases, the actor creates a new risk. And that's why, in response to your question, Judge Jones, Ms. Canada was concentrating on the facts, because it's the facts that establish that a new risk was created. The new risk was created when the steel pipe rack support system was installed out of sequence. Work was performed not by Ridge, but by AMI, in placing the steam pipes first. The pipe rack support system was to go in first, and the pipes were then to be housed in it.
All right,
but they were held by a chain.
I want to stop right there, counsel, because the cite to the record that you have in your briefs for that proposition, all that is a statement that the sequence contributed to the accident. I didn't find any testimony in the record, any indication at all in the record, that AMI, in fact, installed its pipes when it wasn't supposed to. That is, at a different time than the general contractor told it to do so. Where in the record is that evidence?
Your Honor, there's an OSHA report,
right,
which specifically talks about the improper installation of the sequence created was a causal factor in creating the risk of harm.
But it doesn't say that AMI did anything wrong. It just says the sequencing was a factor. It doesn't say AMI was told to do it later. AMI did it before it was supposed to.
Yeah.
It doesn't say that.
And Your Honor, I have to agree. I don't recall anything in the record that said AMI did something wrong.
Well,
what it said was that the installation of the pipes was a causal factor, and obviously that was the opinion of the expert, Mr. Miller, as well, and that the bolt size caused the harm.
But in terms of the sequence, how can that possibly be laid at the feet of AMI when there's no evidence in the record that it actually did anything out of sequence when it wasn't supposed to or allowed to by the general? How can you say they had a duty to do something at a different time when there's no evidence in the record that they were told, don't do it now, do it later?
Your Honor, our position is that the OSHA report takes care of that issue.
Well, that'd be a problem with the general. The general may have allowed something out of sequence that it shouldn't have, but AMI is not the general contractor.
Well, Your Honor, I obviously can't answer that question because I don't know of anything in the record that absolutely says what you're asking for, other than the testimony of Mr. Miller and the OSHA report. It's our position that this is a misfeasance case, not a nonfeasance case. I think that's clear from the briefs. The duty issue for misfeasance is one of fairness based upon contemporary standards. It does not require a special relationship, as the trial court found. So, Your Honor, I think that at this stage of the game, there are material facts that need to be determined on the issue of duty. Court has to determine that, but the court has to apply the right test. And in applying that test, the relevant factors include the risk involved, the foreseeability and likelihood of injury as weighed against the social utility of the actor's conduct, the magnitude of the burden guarding against injury or harm, and the consequences of placing the burden on the actor. And the trial court itself, in prior orders, basically admitted that there was, in fact, issues of fact going to the issue of duty. For example, in its February 2012 order, on second summary judgment, the trial court noted arguably there would be some foreseeability of harm to others if defendant AMI failed to inspect support devices and component parts prior to supplying the hardware, or if defendant AMI supplied improper devices and or parts to Ridge employees. We agree with that. What happened was the court ignored that in its final summary judgment order. So from our perspective, I see that we've got 3 minutes left. I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal unless the court has other questions that they would like to ask me right now.
Thank you.
Thank you. May.
If it pleases honorable court, my name is Richard Waltz. My number is 11567. I'm here on behalf of the defendant AMI Mechanical Systems, Inc. To the court, my esteemed counsel. AMI argued in the trial court and have briefed in this appellate court that it did not have a duty under the facts and circumstances of this case. The citation, the seminal case in Colorado is Taco Bell. We're all familiar with it. The appellate court has cited it repeatedly. Plaintiff's counsel addressed it in their briefs. We have addressed it in our briefs. And what we look at are two of the steps that the Taco Bell court addressed, which is the foreseeability and likelihood of injury as weighed against the social utility of the defendant's conduct and the magnitude of the burden guarding against the injury. In Taco Bell, the court took note of the restatement of tort second 314, which talks about the duty one has if no special relationship exists. The trial court in this case found there is no special relationship between my client and the plaintiff or the plaintiff's employer, and that is the position we are taking. We believe this is a case of nonfeasance, not a case of misfeasance. Why do I say that? First of all, the social utility. What we're talking about is the interaction of two separate trades on a construction site. Those facts are critical to the analysis of what duties should or should not exist between individuals or parties. If they're not related by contract, if they're not related by the job performance, that is, there's no supervisory role of the two trades, the means and methods of how a particular trade does its job is left to that trade. It always has been and always will be. It's how we build things in Colorado. The means and methods in this case involve a tool, a piece of equipment. It's a tool called a hoist ring. What we know is that plaintiff's supervisor came to my client's representative and said, "Do you have a hoist ring?" He said, "Yes, I do." He handed it to him. That is the extent of the contact between my client's representative and the plaintiff's employer.
Well, there's also the earlier interaction in getting permission to use the overhead track, which your client granted.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor, and that's what the record reflects. When you say use of the overhead track, you couldn't use the hoist ring if you didn't
right.
use the track.
And right, that all they worked together. Yeah.
That all took place in about a 30-second exchange in a trailer. That's really what happens. He came and said, "Can we use the hoist ring and use your track?" He says, "Fine."
Here. Now, why is that nonfeasance? I mean, at that point, I can see hypothetically a situation where they come to your client and they say, "Can we use your track system and your hoist ring?" And your client says, "No, you can't use it." And later, for an accident occurs, they see your client saying, "You should have allowed us to use the hoist ring and the track." Now, that's certainly a case of nonfeasance. But here, it seems we have some affirmative conduct. They say, "Yes, you can use it, and here I'm giving you hoist ring to use." That seems like affirmative conduct, not non-conduct.
I will concede that for purposes of the argument I'm going to make then to the court.
Well, it makes a difference because the trial court relied on the special relationship, which is not a factor in misfeasance cases.
That's correct. That only nonfeasance and special relationships exist. The court, however, can, based upon the record before it, decide whether, in fact, even if there was some evidence of misfeasance, under the facts and circumstances of this case and the record before this court, whether there's still a duty that's owed by my client to the plaintiff. That's well within this court's jurisdiction to do that and is an acceptable form of this court reaching a decision. So I'll argue from the standpoint of misfeasance for purposes of my argument. They hand him a tool and say, "Here, use the tool." But they go beyond, in this case, just providing tools. Let's talk about a trap and talk about a ring. My client was not present at the time this occurred. There's citation to cases where there's another...
At the time that the accident occurred or at the time of the transfer?
The only time my client was present was when its representative provided the ring to the plaintiff's supervisor. Thereafter, and it really is a matter of hours, we're talking about a full morning and then the afternoon, that they worked using this in a tunnel that's about a half a mile long, really a quarter of a mile long. And no one from my client was present, no one from my client was supervising, no one from my client was involved. And the accident occurs, they work on it for about 2 hours, then they take a lunch break, and I know there's reference to marijuana, and that's referenced in the trial court's order. They had it, two of the three people who were present had it in their system. They come back, they start to work on it again. The evidence is absolutely certain they did not check the hoist ring. And then it comes unwound. Now we're talking about unwinding here. We're not talking about a ring that was defective. The record is clear. This ring is designed and manufactured to hold 2,500 pounds. The record is clear and undisputed that the beam in question will weigh between 400 and 500 pounds.
So, Mr. Waltz, if I understand the appellant's argument, it is that there is a misfeasance in that they gave the ring to be used, and that having done that, they were obligated further to do something more than just give it to them. And so I guess my question is, what was their duty at the time that they gave the ring? Was their duty greater? I mean, because you're saying the nonfeasance is you gave the ring and then you didn't show up to inspect, in essence. But here, as I understand it, the appellant's argument is, when you gave the ring, your duty was to act in a certain way. It was a misfeasance in that you should never have given the ring, I guess.
I'll respond to the court in this fashion. There's no allegation, no nothing in the record to support that the ring that was provided was inadequate for the purposes for which it was intended. If my client had provided them, for example, and I believe this to be true, a ring that could only hold 100 pounds, and knew that they were going to use steel beams, then some responsibility would lie with my client. But if you give them a ring that you apparently only give them part of it, the bolt is now a question, and who knows where the bolt came from that was used in this ring. But if you don't tell them how to assemble it, if you assume that there has to be assembly in this track, which the court notes, that is, you got to put the nut up inside the bolt and turn it in. And anybody that works, any journeyman iron worker who routinely lifts iron knows that it has to be tightened. How much it's tightened would be left to the person using the tool. But if my client had interjected, had gone down there and supervised, had been involved in some type of advisory capacity, then we wouldn't even be before this court. But all this was providing them the ring. And the suggestion that there's now a question of fact about whether or not this ring has adequate language on it for its use by a journeyman iron worker or his employer or their safety supervisor who was present at the time it was being used has to be left under the Taco Bell analysis, because Taco Bell talks about duty. I know that it deals with nonfeasance and I know that it deals with special relationships, but it talks about what one takes into account from an appellate perspective or trial court's perspective in defining duty. Your duty can't possibly be that unless you give someone an inadequate device, or if you tell them you don't need to do anything with this, or if you go down and supervise it, now you have actively become someone having responsibility. Other than that, you're talking about, from the social utility standpoint, on a construction site, learned tradesmen. And I think it would do a disservice to iron workers, as it would be a disservice to pipe fitters, to suggest one or the other should know how the other does their job.
Well, essentially, our task is to determine whether there was a duty. And as I, and again, Mr. Brady will correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, is that by giving the ring, they created a risk. And having created the risk, then they had certain other duties. And so I, what I'd like to do, I understand how you're applying the misfeasance factors, or some, actually some of them are the same, but where does this, you say that there is no duty to inspect, as I understand it. What was there, by creating a risk, did they create a risk? I mean, I guess that's the question to start with. Did they create a risk?
I hope this addresses your question. In any job, whatever it might be, let's use a law office. Opposing counsel comes in and says, I want to use your computer. I don't sit down and tell them how to use it. I don't sit down and tell them how to use the programs on the computer. My assumption is that they have a working knowledge of the tool that they've asked to borrow from me.
Right, but there you're not creating any risk, or it's not foreseeable that you're creating a risk. Let's say that you give them a weapon of some sort.
Actually, if I might add, no, I do create a risk. Let's say that they can't get the job done and they miss the statute of limitations, so they don't get the file.
Okay.
Well, that's the absurdity in a way of the argument being made. A mere lending of a tool sets in motion a duty to ensure that the tool that's being requested is in fact going to be used properly by a trained, skilled tradesman. And therein lies, I believe, the problem with the plaintiff's argument. They're really suggesting that this court find, and I believe the practical consequence of this is, that all trades are responsible for the means and methods of all other trades on a job site. That would extend liability, ad infinitum. And the plaintiff has cited in here the Weston case, and I'm counsel on the Weston case, the Roe versus Weston case, which they cited the first opinion. Now I've got the second opinion, which was the petition for rehearing. There was a new set of judges, and then they changed the majority. But there was the same kind of argument in that case, where they're saying the duty extends virtually without temporal limitations or without place limitations. I would suggest to this court, and under the facts of this case and the case law that's been cited by my client, and I'll give you two examples. Lewis versus Emil Clayton is an appellate decision, 2001, and that's where a contractor replaced a water heater, and during the course of replacement of it, had access to the gas. Did nothing about it. People were killed as a result of the fat gas leak shortly thereafter. This court said that there was no duty to inspect that gas. In the case of Lego versus Schmidt, which is a far more creative argument used by counsel, that was a case where there were passengers in the car, and the theory of liability was passengers in a car, knowing that there was some erratic behavior by the driver, had an affirmative duty to step in and regulate the conduct of the driver. That's Lego versus Schmidt at 805 P2nd 1119. And the court said, no, we're not going to do that. Now, I know some of these are nonfeasance versus misfeasance. But again, when we're getting back to, and I'm trying very much not to repeat myself with 2 minutes to go, I believe that when one is asked to provide a tool, one can rely on the fact that you fulfilled your duty if you give a tool adequate for the purposes for which it's intended.
Would you agree that if they had given a defective tool, though, that would be a violation of a duty?
I believe that that would create a question of fact that needs to be decided by a fact finder.
Okay, so by giving a bolt that's too short for use, arguably, I understand there's some testimony that that didn't make a difference. Isn't that the equivalent of giving a defective tool?
And what I would say to the court is that when I say defective, I'm talking about inadequate for the purposes intended. If you're taking the position that you're taking, Your Honor, what I'm talking about is I have to leave to them how they're going to use it. I mean, eventually they're going to have to put a bolt on it. Eventually they're going to have to tighten it down. How they may or may not be moving this ring. How they're going to use it is strictly left to the plaintiff and his coworkers. And so this, when we get into inadequacy, I think you're talking more in terms, at least from my perspective, from the defendant's perspective. We're talking in terms of something that can't be used for the purposes for which it's intended. There's nothing in this record. There is nothing in this record that says If this bolt was tightened down as is recommended, that this accident would have occurred. As a matter of fact, I believe the records to the contrary. Had it been tightened down, just tightened down adequately, this accident never would have occurred. All that activity takes place by the plaintiff.
But that goes, it seems to me, to the issue of breach. And yes, I think that we're conflating the issues here. We're focused on, was there a duty? And that was what the trial court was focused on. Let's try to focus on that rather than was there a breach of the duty.
And I would probably end my argument, I have 30 seconds, by citing from this restatement of torts 314, and it's the duty to act for protection of others. It's cited in Whitlock, and it says the fact that the actor should realize that action on his part is necessary for protection of another does not of itself impose upon him a duty to take such action. So that there has to be something beyond me just lending a tool, my client lending a tool, which would create a duty that's recognized in tort for negligence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I think the responses that Mr. Waltz gave to some of the questions of the court show the difficulty in assessing the facts in trying to decide whether or not there is a duty here based upon the misfeasance test. The plaintiff was engaged in a high-risk activity. He was laying steel and hoisting steel channels. He was not familiar, nor were even the AMI employees very familiar, with the recessed channel, channel nut, and hoisting assemblies. It was a new device. Mr. Creech testified to that, the project manager for Ridge, as well as Mr. Thompson. This was a brand new facility. So you've got a brand new facility, you've got the creation of a problem because of a tight space where the Ridge employees could no longer use their come along to hoist the steel. They've now got to use a facility with which they're unfamiliar. And I think that there is instruction in the restatement with respect to this very situation. And I cited it in my brief, and I'll just basically call the court's attention to restatement second of torts, section 390, which basically says that one who supplies or through a third person a chattel, which the supplier knows or has reason to know to be likely because of youth and experience or otherwise, I would substitute unfamiliarity for otherwise, to use it in a manner involving an unreasonable risk of physical harm to himself and others, whom the supplier should expect to share in or to be endangered by its use, is subject to liability for physical harm resulting therefrom. That's the restatement. And that... Restatement second, section 390, 1965.
So is that, what's the duty then? Say, explain to me what that duty is.
The duty is to provide the right part, number one. The wrong part was provided. Number two, the duty is to provide instructions on use of it.
Is there a duty to provide any part?
If they assume to act,
okay,
then they have engaged in the assumption of a duty at that point.
Okay.
And again, it's because of the high-risk nature of the activity with which we're dealing that at least proper instructions and the proper part need to be supplied. They don't have to go over and tell an iron worker how to do his job, but they do have to, if they're undertaking the responsibility for providing a part, to provide the proper part. That's the issue in this case. Mr. Waltz can argue the facts, I can argue the facts, but those material facts are the facts that the court needs to consider on whether or not there is, first of all, a duty, and then the jury will need to decide as to whether or not there's liability for breach of that duty. So I think they're inextricably intertwined in this case, Your Honors. I don't think that you can separate them out in neat packages at this point.
And so the foreseeability, does that come in the determination of whether there's a duty, or does that come in the determination of whether the duty's been breached? Because what you've cited said they're subject to liability if it is foreseeable, if they know or have reason to know, and there's an unreasonable risk.
Your Honor, I think if the court looks at the Jacquet versus Public Service Company case, the relevant factors in determining duty are set forth. And one of those factors is the foreseeability and likelihood of injury as weighed against the social utility of the conduct. So I think it does come in on that issue. I also think it comes in on the issue of causation as well, the foreseeability of harm as a result of the breach. So as I said, I think they're inextricably intertwined, and I don't think that we can separate them out into nice, neat packages as sometimes we like to do as lawyers and judges. I think in this case, you've got to consider them under both issues.
Is that case you just referenced in your briefs?
It is, Your Honor.
And can you give me a spelling of it?
It's J-A-C-Q-U-E.
Okay.
The Public Service Company of Colorado, found at 89 Pacific 2nd, 138, Colorado Appeal Court, 1994.
Thank you.
Well, again, I'll close by saying we did raise one other final argument, and that was the wrong of another argument based on the Parsons versus Festival case, which the court said was not a freestanding tort. But I would submit that if we're going to recognize under Colorado law that a party who is a litigant in a lawsuit can sue the opposing expert witness for a breach of duty, it seems rather anomalous to me that we would allow a duty issue to exist there and not find one under the circumstances of this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. As you can tell, we're grappling with this case, and your argument's been very helpful. We appreciate it. This case now stands submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you very much.